And joining us today is Nigel Hamilton. Nigel is a best-selling biographer of the John F. Kennedy book, General Bernard Monty Montgomery, President Bill Clinton. He's also won the Templar Medal for Military History and the Whitbread Prize for Biography. His book, The Mantle of Command, FDR at War, 1941 to 42, was longlisted for the National Book Award and was followed by Commander-in-Chief, FDR's Battle with Churchill, 1943. He is a senior fellow at the McCormick Graduate School, University of Massachusetts, Boston, and he splits his time between Boston and New Orleans, and he was kind enough to set some time apart for us today. This is his final book of the trilogy, War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945. And I just want to let our listeners know that this show is being taped, and we are taping on the June 6th, 75th anniversary of D-Day. Nigel, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Not at all. Delighted to be with you.
Now, I mentioned a little bit about your background, some of the other books, but I want to dig a little bit deeper. Even so, when you were a young man, tell us a little bit about you growing up.
Well, Louis, I was born in 1944, just a few months before D-Day. In fact, my father was rehearsing with his battalion for the D-Day invasion in Norfolk on the east coast of England. And he was second in command of his battalion, but the commanding officer was taken ill. And so at age 25, he took 1,000 men across the English Channel as part of the D-Day invasion. And during the Battle of Normandy, which began that day, 6th of June, over 600 men in his battalion of 1,000 men became casualties. So for him, it was a very tough, extraordinary combat story. And after the war, he would take my three brothers and me back to Normandy. I never really understood at the time because I was so small. We were about 5, 6, 7 years old. Each summer, he would take us to Brittany into Normandy. I think it was sentimental in the sense that he felt they had taken such colossal casualties, but at the same time, he was very proud of what he'd done. And for a young man who'd been evacuated from Dunkirk as a second lieutenant in 1940, to have been able to go back across that English Channel and liberate France and ultimately Holland, which is where he ended the war, and in Germany, you know, he had great cause for being proud of what had been achieved by the Allies.
Did your dad talk much about it in addition to taking you to Normandy?
Not really at the time. he told us a few stories of, you know, little things that had happened in the battle. But, you know, we were so very young, I don't think we would have understood. You know, we played in these German blockhouses overlooking the ocean and, you know, we played soldiers or cops and robbers, but, you know, we were too young to really understand. And it was only at the end of his life, because after the war, he was a volunteer. After the war, he went back into journalism. He'd been a junior reporter on a local newspaper in the north of England. He became a very distinguished English journalist, editor-in-chief of the London Times, and he fell ill himself and with cancer, sadly, and asked me to help him write a memoir of his life before he died. And that was the first time that he really sort of opened up about his experiences.
Nigel, I think perhaps our listeners might be interested in that memoir. Is it still out, and what is it called?
It's called Editor-in-Chief by Dennis Hamilton. So Dennis Hamilton, I think it's still available, but I mean, it's out of print, but one can get copies of it. And the strange thing was, I thought he would want to tell me more about his life as a Fleet Street editor during a sort of great period of English journalism in the 1960s, when the Sunday Times became a world newspaper, really, when he was editor. But in fact, he most wanted to talk about being a battalion commander in World War II. And, of course, it was that experience which he won the DSO, the Distinguished Service Order, at Nijmegen several months after the Bridge Too Far, defending the Nijmegen Bridge just before the Battle of the Bulge, and he was decorated in the field, and the medal was signed off by Field Marshal Montgomery, who at the end of the war was looking for young officers to take senior positions in the new model army, as Monty called it, sort of hearkening back to Cromwell, of course. He wanted to head up a much slimmed-down British army that could help sort of oversee not just national security, but the sort of wind-down of the British Empire after World War II. But my father was totally exhausted. Anyway, they stayed in touch, and at the Sunday Times, my father was able, as editor, to publish extracts from Montgomery's very controversial war memoirs, and in which, unfortunately, Monty was rather critical of General Eisenhower, who'd become President of the United States at that point. Anyway, it was through that relationship with between my father and Field Marshal Montgomery that I came, as a young student, to know Montgomery very, very well. In fact, intimately, to stay with him at his in retirement at his converted watermill, Hampshire, in England. And I was just a college student at the time, but I was amazed when Monty told me that we were going off for the weekend to stay with Winston Churchill. And, you know, at the time I was 19, and, you know, I didn't think that much of it. You know, I had an amazing weekend, but at the time, you know, one is in adolescence, you know, the world is so new and dramatic and so forth. I didn't think too much of it. But, of course, years later, as a biographer and historian, you know, when you are struggling to kind of get into the mind of some of these really senior figures, leaders of World War II, I have to say it gave me a certain confidence that even where I felt as a historian or as a biographer I needed to be critical of these characters, I felt confident that I wasn't just basing my knowledge on archival documents, which never actually tell the whole truth, but, you know, that I had a personal, not a personal stake in this, because I don't think, I try to be reasonably objective, that I had a certain unusual connection with the subject, and particularly with these two great leaders, Churchill and Montgomery. Montgomery, obviously, having been the general who commanded the American, British, and Canadian armies at D-Day.
We're visiting with award-winning author and historian Nigel Hamilton. His book is the final in the FDR trilogy. This one's called War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945. Nigel, I'm glad that you shared with us about your experience being with General Montgomery and also with Prime Minister Winston Churchill, because sometimes people will say, well, you know, that's written from the British perspective. That's written from the American perspective. You, as you mentioned, you know, you write these biographies and you want to remain objective. And the ones that I've read of yours, I think you have. But there are some leaders who are afraid, perhaps, about what history will say about them. And in fact, Mr. Churchill, Prime Minister Churchill, was one of those. And he said that he intended history to be good to him because he intended to write it.
Exactly. That's a famous, one of the many wonderful Churchill quotes. He was quite open about it. And, of course, he did write it. As you say, he wrote, not only did he write it, he wrote six volumes of it. And he didn't call them his memoirs, as Monty called his autobiography. He called it the Second World War. I mean, that was to be the definitive account written by Winston Churchill, who'd been there and, after all, knew it all backwards. And absolutely brilliantly written. He had a whole team of historians and former members of his government helping him. But he was the one who actually put it all together and and wrote the prose. And it is, you know, it's a really epic, magisterial achievement, those six volumes. And they helped him to win the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1953, I think deservedly. The problem for a historian is that obviously Churchill was who'd lost power as Prime Minister in 1945 when he was voted out of office. He wanted to get back into Downing Street as Prime Minister, and therefore he had a, you know, a personal agenda to paint his role in World War II as colorfully but also as positively as possible. And I think probably all of us can agree that Churchill was the man who basically saved Western civilization in 1940 in his finest hour. I mean, the one great leader who stood against Hitler. But his military leadership after 1940 is really very, very, I would go so far as saying very suspect. You know, it's almost a history of disasters, and rather covered up by the fact that his opposite number, namely the President of the United States, who constitutionally holds the role of Commander-in-Chief of American forces, was basically so nice to him and so tolerant and patient with him during the war, but who did not live, FDR, to write his own account of World War II. And that was why 10 years ago, I decided I'd been writing a book about the 12 presidents from FDR, modeled on an old Roman, famous Roman text called the 12 Caesars, and I called mine American Caesars. And I wanted to look at those 12 presidents after World War II, from World War II onwards, to show how they had performed their roles really as world leaders. And I was astonished that there was no real study of FDR as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States in the most violent war in human history. And that the British, in a sense, even though I was born British, had kind of occupied the field with Winston Churchill and a host of other historians and commanders writing their versions of World War II. And so the American story of the strategy of World War II, certainly in the West, in the fight against Hitler, had rather been ceded to Churchill and British historians. And so, to some extent, my trilogy is an attempt to give FDR's perspective on all this, because I do think that FDR has been very underrated. I think he, by history, because he died in April of 45, just 2 weeks before Hitler committed suicide, and wasn't able to give his account. He had been preparing his papers to do so, but he died too soon. And I think it is, in my view, he is really the most successful military strategist, American military strategist, in American history, and certainly the most successful global strategist of World War II. But if you speak to most people, you know, they tend not to think of him that way. They tend to think of him in terms of the New Deal and domestic policy and as a great statesman. But they don't think of him as this military strategist. And so, to some degree, my trilogy is a kind of corrective of history.
We're visiting with award-winning author and historian Nigel Hamilton. His final book in the Roosevelt trilogy is FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943-45, War and Peace. You mentioned a little while ago, Nigel, the fact that you were born in Britain and you were raised up in Britain. And just out of curiosity, this is the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and there were some commemorations going on in England showing Queen Elizabeth and President Trump. How has anything changed as far as recognizing and remembering these great men and women?
Well, I think the British still do pay much more attention to that remembrance than we do here, perhaps for understandable reasons. But I think for, you know, the United States emerged from World War II as this superpower, you know, and as time went on, as the sole global superpower. That now today is very much under threat, but it has been so that the United States has more or less dominated and directed world security since World War II on a global scale. And therefore, you know, there's been, despite some disasters, considerable pride and confidence in having safeguarded that new world order, as people call it. But that wasn't the same. That wasn't true in Britain, certainly when I was growing up. You know, there was a sense that Britain was reluctantly discarding its colonial empire and the retreat from empire. And there was some embarrassment, some shame, some sadness, and definitely nostalgia. And in that respect, honoring the memory of a world war in which Britain, under Prime Minister Churchill, you know, stood for a time alone against the Nazis and then combined in this grand alliance with the United States to defeat Hitler, is probably the proudest memory that most older British citizens have. And that's sort of been inherited a lot by their relatives and their children. And so I think it is a very special day for British people. I know I did, when I still lived in Britain, I was a historian at the Imperial War Museum, and I wrote a little book for the Queen, who was going over to the D-Day beaches and to Caen, just as a sort of little aide memoir with color photographs of her father's trip to the beaches of Normandy after the D-Day invasion. And I helped contributed to a speech she gave about the great battle in Normandy, and I was proud to do it, and I'm sure, you know, I was one of many people then, but still today, who think of that as, you know, one of the proudest moments in English history.
We're visiting with award-winning author and historian Nigel Hamilton. His third book in the FDR World War II trilogy is War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945. Nigel, you were mentioning earlier about, you know, the president and his memoirs. And, you know, a lot of presidents, once they get in office, they start working on their papers. How is history going to remember them? But President Roosevelt, even though some people knew that he was not well, he was feeling sick, they weren't expecting him to die suddenly as he did. And with that happening, how did you get access? How were you handpicked, or were you, to gather all these FDR papers and be able to write this incredible trilogy?
No, I wasn't handpicked. I was handpicked to write Montgomery's life story, which I did in three volumes in the late 1970s and early 1980s. But no, I became an American citizen, and as I say, I'd been writing about American presidents since FDR, and I was just so disappointed that nobody had seen fit, no American historian had seen fit to record FDR's military command in World War II. So I, to be honest, Louis, I thought it would be a short book and a single one. I never expected it to be three volumes. And I remember when I finished the first volume, I sent the manuscript to my editor at Houghton Mifflin, and he sent an email a few days later saying, "Nigel, I reached page 800. We're only up to 1942. Where's the rest of the war?" And, you know, I realized that this, because nobody had ever done it before, this was going to be a much bigger undertaking and would probably take a lot longer than I'd expected. But it has been an extraordinary experience, and I've gotten to know a number of members of the Roosevelt family through it. But also, one of the great wonderful things that happened was I was able to interview last surviving senior officer in Roosevelt's map room. You know, like people talk about Churchill's war rooms in London, which President Trump went to see a day or two ago. Well, the fact is, many people don't realize that FDR had his own war room, and it was actually set up on the ground floor of the White House in a former ladies' cloakroom. But it became really the global hub for communications in World War II on a global scale. I mean, any message coming back from, say, MacArthur in the Philippines or from Eisenhower in North Africa, whatever, it all went through this map room on the first floor of the White House, or ground floor, rather, and right next to the president's elevator. And if he didn't go into, if the president didn't go into the map room, his naval attaché or his army attaché would take the papers up to him. And having that chance to interview and talk for several days with the officer he was a Harvard graduate who'd been chosen to work in this map room soon after Pearl Harbor and stayed there right to the very end of the war. In fact, he went on president's behalf to Normandy and actually participated in the D-Day invasion to report back to the president. That chance to interview with people like that was a tremendous bonus. But I mean, a lot of it was just the sort of foot slogging that a historian has to do, you know, going through archives after archives, searching for the true story. And when I say true story, I mean to try and get as an authentic account as is possible today. Often in diaries and letters written at the time. I mean, I think I did feel very strongly that here was a chance, as nobody had done this before, to try and put the reader into the White House as the war was taking place, whether it was Pearl Harbor or the loss of the Philippines or the American Great American Torch invasion of North Africa or Sicily or D-Day itself, to use these diaries and letters to make the reader feel that you're right in the room with the President of the United States as he has to make these extraordinary historic decisions.
We're visiting with award-winning author and historian Nigel Hamilton. Nigel's final book in the trilogy of FDR is called War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945. In the book, also, as you just mentioned, you had access to unpublished diaries and interviews. So some people may say, well, there have been a lot of books written about FDR and World War II and D-Day. However, what you share with us, the reader, are some of the things that nobody even knew were around, and as you mentioned earlier, almost like being right there in the Oval Office with the president.
Well, thank you for asking, Louis, because in many ways, this book was a revelation to me as a historian. You know, I'd grown up reading Churchill's memoirs and then subsequent war accounts, knowing Field Marshal Montgomery personally, but also doing the research for the three volumes I wrote about his life. I felt I was certainly reasonably fluent in the in the historiography of World War II, and I was really myself amazed by how little we have known about the great crisis that took place at the end of 1943 in terms of D-Day. And I would go so far as to say that the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, saved the D-Day invasion, something I don't think most Americans and certainly no British citizens are aware of. Because right at the end of 1943, at the end of November 1943, the president set off on the latest U.S. battleship, the USS Iowa, to North Africa to meet with Churchill. And Churchill simultaneously set off from Britain aboard his battleship, HMS Renown. And Churchill was determined to have what he called a showdown with the President of the United States, because Churchill basically had decided the British would not go ahead with the D-Day invasion. And I wonder how many people are today aware of this. It really was a critical moment in World War II, and the way the president dealt with it is an amazing story. I mean, one in which Roosevelt had to use all his charm, patience, but also this steely reserve that he had within himself to put down what was basically a British insurrection. And the fact was, the D-Day landings, which were set to take place on the 1st of May in 1944, that was a few months later, these landings could not take place without the British. The British would have to furnish at least 50% of the forces, as well as a huge amount of naval craft and as much Air Force support as possible. And there was Winston Churchill going out to the Middle East, to Cairo, to tell the President of the United States that the British weren't going to do it. And the way that Roosevelt handled that crisis, I think, is really one of the most historic moments in world history. Because without that invasion, I don't know that we would have lost World War II, but we might well have had to come to some negotiated settlement with the Nazis, who were still in occupation of most of Europe, and whom the Russians certainly couldn't defeat on their own. The final volume turned out to be far more dramatic, really, than I had expected it to be.
And it's a book that's available. You can find the rest of the books in the trilogy. Do you have a website, Nigel?
Through my university, the University of Massachusetts, Boston, but not a personal website.
Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to be with us, to share with us the insight that you found and had writing this trilogy. The final book is War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945. Nigel, thank you so much.
Not at all.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Cassiano. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.